All righty, it's Bowerly. We'll talk more about the debate tomorrow. It's like, I don't really think I have to struggle for topics tomorrow. Not that I ever struggle for topics. I've got a list on my wall of a gazillion topics. We will be joined momentarily by Buffalo attorney Paul Cambria to talk about the how you go about prosecuting and sentencing young people for such heinous acts as the city witnessed back on the last Friday night, the murder of Ramon Carter. So Paul Cambria should be joining us shortly. And you want to just double check the number that I sent to Paul there, Tanner? Sorry about this, guys. Yep. All right. He does have the correct number. Sometimes when I'm typing in phone numbers, the strangest things happen. Like, it'll be 716 vomit face 5-2 a.m. It's like, what? Anyway, we'll talk about that with Paul Cambria on News Radio 930 WBEN. All righty. We are awaiting, and we're just getting Paul Cambria set up here for the show on News Radio 930 WBEN to talk about this obviously tragic story, but quick arrests and where it goes from here, because there's a whole process that must be gone through. And if you have any questions during the course of our conversation with Paul Cambria, we invite you to call in at 803-0930, star 930 on the cell phone, and 1-800-616-WBEN. Tanner, I'm going to let you bring up Paul Cambria, just if we have any questions or any calls who have questions about this situation, they can get through. Paul, thanks very much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Not a problem.
So, you have been a defense attorney for a long time. In a situation like this, when you've got a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, what are some of the legal considerations that we, the uninitiated, should keep in mind?
Well, the law already looks at, if you will, the fact that somebody is young. For example, the 14-year-old would not be treated like an adult. The adult would be facing a minimum of 15 years to life and a maximum of 25 to life. The 16-year-old would be considered an adult. So that would be the range of what he could be facing. The 14-year-old, on the other hand, would be a minimum sentence of 7.5 to life and a maximum of 15 to life. So the law already takes into account the age situation.
Can you explain the legal doctrine under which if you are involved in a felony that has the foreseeable consequences of something very horrible happening, you are as guilty as the person who pulls the trigger?
Right. It's called felony murder. And, for example, if I start someone's house on fire and I don't realize that there's somebody in the house and they die, that's felony murder, and it's treated just like I went in there and shot them. It is a so-called A felony, which is the highest felony we have. And so basically what it says is if you commit the felony, you're stuck with the consequences. And so even if you didn't know that somebody was in the house, for example, if you burned it down, you're going to be responsible not only for the fire, but also for the murder.
And take that one step further. My understanding is if I drove you to the scene where you were going to start the fire and I knew what you were going to do, I also would be considered a candidate for a felony murder charge, correct?
Yeah, that's a little bit different factual scenario there. Usually, if people plan together to do something, they either can be charged as conspirators or as so-called aiders and abettors. And that would be the situation in the factual situation you just posed. They'd be either conspirators. Let's say we both agreed we're going to drive there and you're going to go in and torch the house. That'd be a conspiracy. If, on the other hand, somebody said, hey, give me a ride to this house, I'm going to torch it, you could then possibly be an aider and abettor. And in both situations, you know, you're treated as if you're the person doing it alone.
Paul, to the degree to which you are able to discuss such matters, given attorney-client privilege and the sacrosanct relationship between those two entities, have you dealt with any cases that involve 14-year-olds or 16-year-olds facing these kinds of charges of such a heinous act?
Yes. Yes, I have. And, you know, usually you start off... Before the law was revised, it wasn't as easy as it, well, easy. There wasn't a spot for somebody 14 versus 16. And so you tried to keep it in family court as opposed to Supreme Court. Now, basically, there's a youth division, if you will, of Supreme Court. And the cases are handled there, and the statute deals with the difference in punishment according to the age of the individual. Once you hit 16, you're an adult. And even though it may be handled in a youth bureau of Supreme Court, at that age you still are an adult and punished as an adult with, you know, the maximum punishment, which is 25 to life for a murder. So yeah, I've had those. And in the past, you know, some where it was clear that there wasn't a viable defense, then you're negotiating with the district attorney and you look toward things such as immaturity or disabilities. When somebody is, you know, really young, you have a better chance at negotiating lower punishments and crimes when somebody is very, very young. But now the statute's been overhauled, if you will, to kind of take all that in consideration.
So when let's just stick with the 14-year-old suspect in this case. When you have dealt with 14-year-olds finding themselves facing such serious charges, do like 90% of those is a plea deal worked out, or do they end up going to a full jury or bench trial?
Well, that depends on the facts. You know, the age wouldn't faze me as far as if I thought it was defendable. It would be a matter of, you know, what are the facts? Is this a situation where there's, you know, video? And I say that seems like an extreme example, but you would be surprised how much video there is, especially now with, you know, doorbell cameras and things like that. And if it's obvious that you can't win, you're better off trying to plea bargain for something less than you would be convicted of. On the other hand, if you feel you have a valid defense on the merits, hey, I didn't do it, or maybe there's a legal defense, which would be like, well, you got the evidence, but you violated my Fourth Amendment rights because it was an illegal search. You know, you would evaluate those as a defense lawyer and then decide, is this a tribal case? Do I have a legitimate shot that I would say to my client, look, you know, here's what happens. We can roll the dice, and your chances, in my opinion, are X, or there's been a reduced charge offered to you, and, you know, it's your decision ultimately, but the lawyer would give a recommendation, but wouldn't make the final decision.
And in the case of somebody that young, does a parent or parents have any say over which way it goes, plea or full trial?
Well, yeah, for sure, because obviously the child's not in a position, especially if you're like 14 years old or even 16, you're really not in a position to evaluate the probability or possibility of conviction of something more heinous than is available through plea bargain. So, yeah, the parents come in into place. And if there are no parents, then a guardian could be appointed by the court, a legal guardian, to advise the child, work with the child.
In your experiences dealing with, again, keeping with somebody around the age of 14 years old, what is the general emotion they express? Is it one of shock that it happened? Is it remorse? Or do you get kids who just don't give a damn?
Well, actually, it's probably all the above. There are some who are, you know, hardened or grew up on the streets, basically, you know, survival of the fittest sort of thing. And their mentality is a little different than somebody who, you know, lives in the suburbs and what? This could happen to me? And, you know, you mean I can't play golf tomorrow? You know, something like that. You get the whole gamut. And, you know, each individual, even as adults, we have adults that don't appreciate certain things when you're discussing the law and the potentials with them and so on. So that's where the, you know, they call us attorneys and counselors at law. That's where the counselor part sort of comes in.
Paul Cambria is with us on News Radio 930 WBEN, obviously discussing the arrests of the 14-year-old and the 16-year-old, which we cannot name, whom we cannot name, and the legal aspects of this very tragic case. Paul Cambria has handled cases like this involving very serious charges brought against very young people and is offering fascinating insight. If you have any questions or comments for Paul, 803-0930, *930 on the cell phone, and 1-800-616-WBEN. And why is it that they don't release the names of offenders even in such a horrible case like this, which saddened the entire community?
Well, I think it's policy, really. If you think about it, in cases where there's an allegation of sexual misconduct, rape, things like that, they don't release the names there either. And I think here, because they're so young and the law already recognizes special rules for young people, the thought being, and the reason for those laws, is that the thought is at that age, you know, your judgment isn't fully formed. It's not matured. At that point, you may make mistakes when you're younger, and there sort of gives you a little bit of excuse room, if you will, for some of the things that you might do at those ages. And it's like, well, we won't tag those on you for the rest of your life because somebody remembers a newscast and your name was, pasted all over.
In cases where you've dealt with 14-year-olds charged with serious felonies, maybe years ago, Paul, what percentage of those people are able to turn their lives around as adults and lead productive lives? And roughly what percentage turn out to be recidivists?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I find that it's almost the same percentage whether they were very young at the time of their crime or older, adult age, that serious crimes, if you're convicted or if you're acquitted or if you've made some kind of plea bargain, have a tendency to register with most people and kind of a life-changing event. Now, some people are basically hardened criminals. This is what they do. This is their job in their mind. And they just keep going and, you know, say, well, we got to keep trying to get away with it sort of thing. But I find that most of the people who are not career criminals, that they do change as a result of something serious. And sometimes it doesn't even require jail. You know, it just requires all of the shunning you're going to get from your family and your friends and people at school and all the rest of it. It has a major impact on most people for the better, let's say.
No, that's very interesting. Paul, I would like you to stick around, or you can call back at 535, 536, and you can, you know, get something done at home if you want to. But I'd like to join you after the news and have a few more questions for you on this situation, because I can think of few people I'd rather talk to about it than Paul Cambria.
All right. I'll be driving, but we can still make it happen.
We will make it happen, because that's what we do on News Radio 930 WBEN. It is 526. We'll continue talking with defense attorney Paul Cambria on News Radio 930 WBEN. And if you do have any questions that you want to get into Paul, you can call. Otherwise, trust me, I'm happy to just talk to Paul. But I don't want to exclude you from the show either, because you're important. 803-0930, star 930, and 1-800-616-WBEN. Hey, here's a drinking game. What if you took a sip every time I gave the phone number or said the call letters, WBEN? You would last 10 minutes before you'd be snoggered. That's the word I made up today. Thank you. You are just a horrible human being today. It's gotten into you. You've been nipping at that tequila I got you for your birthday yesterday? Maybe. Maybe. Anyway, it's Bowerly, and let's get back to serious land, talking with attorney Paul Cambria on News Radio 930 WBEN about the 14-year-old and the 16-year-old arrested in the horrific murder of a 3-year-old cute little kid, Ramon Carter, who is never going to see 4 years of age. Paul, once in the case of the 14-year-old, once that matter is adjudicated either at trial or through a plea bargain, where does that 14-year-old go for incarceration?
Well, there's special incarceration facilities that are segregated just for youthful individuals. And, you know, they obviously have counselors and things like that that would be necessary for them as they're growing up and maturing.
My understanding is that there are different hierarchies within prisons. Kill a cop and you are a hero of an inmate, but kill a baby and your popularity might not be that high. And I told this story yesterday, but back in the 1920s in the beer wars in New York City, a group of gangsters on Vincent Mad Dog Cole's side killed a little kid when they were going for one of Dutch Schultz's guys, and to his dying day, Vincent Cole, the Mad Mick he was called baby killer, a charge which he vehemently denied. If a 14-year-old goes to one of these youthful convict incarceration places, is a 14-year-old who is complicit in the murder of a 3-year-old going to have an extremely difficult time, that is presuming guilt, even though we have the presumption of innocence?
Well, I mean, not having been in the system as an administrator or anything, but having talked to lots of them, it's a little different when an adult kills a child or when adults involved in rape or something like that. They're the ones that have a lot of exposure to violence. And when you're talking about someone who's very young, they will, be housed with other people who are young. And I would think, and I, you know, like I say, I'm not in the correction system, but I would think that it would be a different mentality. I think if you're an adult, kills a child, that's one thing. If you're a child, kills a child, I think it's a lesser dangerous situation.
Now, as to the case of the 16-year-old, how is that matter going to be handled?
Well, the 16-year-old can be treated as an adult. I mean, the 16-year-old can get the full shot as far as prison is concerned. They're treated like adults. There's a special division of our Supreme Court that deals with youth, if you will, but nevertheless, the 16-year-old basically can can be treated like an adult and be sentenced like one. The 14-year-old who has the reduced situation.
Now, it, I don't mean to go all over the place, but in both cases, actually, involving both the 14-year-old and the 16-year-old, are victim impact statements permissible and encouraged?
Well, always. Victims and their families have the ability to speak at sentencing, and they do have an impact. Judges will tell you that they do. Now, what usually happens is that before someone is sentenced, the defense lawyers, the prosecution, and individuals who are part of the district attorney's office, who are victim advocates, all have the ability to submit information and recommendations to the court. And the court then and them modify them, disregard them. You know, it's in the sole judgment of the court as to what the ultimate punishment is. But I can tell you that there have been plenty of cases where there are victims and they have made a difference in what the sentence is.
Now, you know, I'm thinking back to the mass shooting at that church in South Carolina. I think it was in Charleston, where the white kid went into a black church and ended up killing people with whom he was praying. And afterward, I was blown away by the amount of forgiveness that was expressed by these very freshly and acutely hurt people who had just lost loved ones. Now, moving the clock forward and bringing it back to this Buffalo situation, if members of the family stand up in court and say, look, we are community activists. We believe there are too many people of color who are incarcerated for far too long. We would like to appeal for leniency for these six, for the 16-year-old and the 14-year-old, because they're simply babies themselves. Is that likely to have any impact on the court, given the public, the greater public's concern about the rise in violent crime?
Well, you know, every judge is an individual with their own proclivities. Some judges, that may very well resonate and influence what they do. Other judges who may be more conservative, hardline, you know, law and order people, it's going to be like, you did the crime and you're going to get the punishment that I think you deserve. Yes, it's terrible, but I'm gonna give you, you know, what I feel you're going to get anyway, and not be influenced. It makes it easier for judges when you do have people in the community who are connected, if you will, family members and so on, saying, you know, we believe in God and religion and forgiveness and all the rest of it. It makes it easier if a judge wants to reduce a sentence for them to do it.
What legally would the next steps be for the 14-year-old?
Well, we assume they have counsel. Counsel will review the what material is available, which they call discovery. Counsel will decide on the mental situation of their client, evaluate that themselves, as to whether or not they think they should call in a professional. They will do that. Then they'll review all the evidence and decide how strong their case is, what the best defense, if you will be under the circumstances. You know, in some cases we have legal issues that happen, searches that shouldn't have happened, things like that. So you will evaluate those. In cases without those, you look also at the facts and, you know, the probability of conviction, and the you measure if they're convicted, because we think that there is substantial evidence that will not be barred in any way in the courtroom, and we think that they'll be convicted, and this will be what the penalty is they're facing, and then you measure that against what may be an available plea bargain for someone because of their youth, immaturity, or what have you. So there's a lot to it. There are a lot of different considerations that a defense lawyer has to make in every criminal case.
And the same legal procedures are going to apply to the 16-year-old in terms of discovery and evaluation of mental capacity, et cetera?
Yeah, basically, all those things are in place no matter what your age. And funds are available. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed. And if you need witnesses, like psychiatrists or what have you, they will be funded as well. The system is a good system, and for the most part, it works.
Well, at least with the assigned counsel, they finally have increased rates to a point where it's a lot better than it used to be. Here is Ed in Buffalo. Ed, you are on with Paul Cambria on WBEN. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. What can you do, or is there a law, to go after the individuals that gave a 14-year-old a gun? Whoever gave these kids the guns should be the ones that are on trial. A 14-year-old, they're just knuckleheads. They're just stupid. But
I don't know if somebody gave them a gun or they, obtained one surreptitiously, stole it from their dad's drawer or something. I don't know what that's all about. If someone actually knowingly gave someone a gun who wasn't licensed or legally of age to have one and so on, they could have accessory responsibility criminally for aiding and abetting. Now, I say that, but aiding and abetting also requires the intent to commit a crime or a negligence. And this would be more of a negligence anyway.
Right, but handing a 14-year-old a gun, he's not going to be using it for BB practice. It's going to be for a crime.
Yeah, no doubt about it. In a situation like that, you would clearly be an aider and abettor, and you could be possibly held liable to the full degree of the crime.
That would be awesome. And I think that's what they should be going after and publishing wherever they got this gun from, or guns.
Oh, I'm sure they've been asked that, or they will be asked that at a future date. Ed, thank you very much. And, I mean, Paul, there's always the possibility they might have bought it on the street from some guy who came in for the day from some other state to sell guns.
No doubt. Could have stolen it from an adult or someone who had the gun legally. Lots of possibilities.
Talking with attorney Paul Cambria on WBEN. Paul, you were talking about mental capacity being evaluated by experts. And I need a little bit of help understanding this because many years ago, a man named John Hinckley Jr., whose family just happened to be friends with George Herbert Walker Bush's family, tried to murder President Ronald Reagan. And during the trial, there were a bunch of psychiatrists who were called in to evaluate John Hinckley, and some of the psychiatrists with prestigious degrees from elite schools said, this guy is nutty as a fruitcake, well, in medical parlance, and other psychiatrists said, he is absolutely sane and he understands that what he did was wrong at the time he did it. So to what extent does such a subjective science play in determining the outcome of a case, a plea, or a sentence?
We rarely see the mental disease or defect defense used in a courtroom or used successfully. I'm thinking back over my career, and I think it maybe came up twice as a possibility, and I did not use it. Basically, the test is that the person doesn't know in a
investigate the nature and extent of their activities and that they are wrong. That basically is a, that would be a successful defense if the jury found that. I don't see it. In certain circumstances, people have been found not guilty by reason of so-called insanity, and then they're basically packed away and stored in an institution, and many times longer than they would serve if they were convicted of a crime. Mm. Not murder, obviously, but some other crime. And so it's a very rarely used, I can't think of the last case, in Buffalo, maybe Gail, what was her name?
Trait, Gail Trait.
Cut her kids up in little pieces, and they found she was safe. That's the last one I can remember.
Yeah, and Gail Trait has done her time, and at last word was a success, a productive member of society, which I don't think anybody could have foreseen back when her name was all over the place. And I think the first use of a temporary insanity defense was when future Union General Dan Sickles gunned down his wife's lover, who was, I think, the kid of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, and that defense was used by Edwin Stanton, who would later become Secretary of War under Abraham Lincoln, and it actually worked.
Well, how about in San Francisco, where the Twinkie defense?
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? Where they basically said that, you know, he was affected mentally to the point of not being responsible criminally because he had eaten some Twinkies. And there was some sort of sugar run or something where he killed a guy named Milk. You recall that?
Harvey Milk, yeah. Actually, remember that. And even I wasn't on the air during the Stanton defense of Dan Sickles. Paul, I want to thank you very much. I could talk about this stuff with you all day long. Tragic circumstances, but we certainly appreciate the added information about the legal process and how it is going to unfold as this case moves on. Once again, we find ourselves deeply in your debt. Paul Cambria, thank you very much.
Yeah, Tom, I'm glad to do it because there's a lot of misunderstanding about the ins and outs of the law, and we get a chance to kind of put the right information out there.
Well, I like to talk about this because late at night I read New York penal law. But anyway, I really do. Thank you very much, Paul Cambria on WBEN. At some point I'll get to criminal procedure law, but it's fascinating reading. To me, it's like, wow, this is amazing. Anyway, thanks to Tanner Saunders for a job poorly done today. Just because of, you know, it just, he played David Allan Coe, and then it just went downhill from there. Hank Williams Jr. was a good choice, but then throwing the Carpenters and the Captain and Tennille onto the show, I got to talk to HR about that. That was an infliction of direct emotional duress.
So what you're saying is I should expect to be getting an email from Tim and Lisa tomorrow about my termination?
I doubt it. It's never going to happen. Not on my watch. It's not going to. You go, I go, baby. How's that? I got your back.
It's like Titanic. You jump, I jump.
And the waters in Wisconsin are so cold, it's like 1,000 knives going through you. And she wouldn't let him on the raft with her. Think about that for just a moment. And it was a totally fictional story about the love affair. Yet people went to the cemetery in Nova Scotia, as we mentioned yesterday, to pay homage to the grave of a man who happened to have been named Dawson. Weird. All right. Well, thank you very much. I mean, it's just not healthy to be obsessed with a movie that way. In a related development, I want to go to Dallas very soon to go to Dealey Plaza. Anyway, it's Bowerly on News Radio 930 WBEN. Tom Puckett coming up with Buffalo's Evening News from 6 until 7. And again, thanks to Paul Cambria. And thanks for your calls today. Tomorrow, gee, I don't know what we're going to talk about. You think the debate's going to come up? Yes, on News Radio 930 WBEN. Thanks also to Michael Masiello, watching how it's all done, how the magic comes together.